Con going for you so far? Another great year. So my name is Ilanka Dunan, and I will be speaking about geocaching and some other location-based games. So I've also got a few other people on the panel here, so we'll start off with some quick introductions. Then I want to ask a couple questions of you in the audience, kind of find out what your interests are, and then we will launch into it. So we'll start here.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Termeshazen. I have a master's in cybersecurity. Last time I went geocaching on a serious basis, we were still using pen and paper, and it used to be called orienteering. So all you young whippersnappers with the GPSs, have fun with that. I've been doing cybersecurity and location-based things for about 20 years. Lots of fun, and it's good to be on the panel with you.
Okay. My name is Blake Sorensen. I do geocaching as a hobby, but in my day job, I'm someone who causes feedback in microphones.
you do that well.
Yeah. And I'm also an intellectual property attorney. I work for a company called AirWatch here in Atlanta, and we do a lot of mobile device management controls that involve geofencing so that you can only access certain data in certain locations.
Kind of cool. I'm Eric Klossel. I actually only really geocache. I don't do any of this professionally. I'm more of the amateur, if you will, of all of it.
You mean I can get paid for geocaching?
Yeah, don't I wish. Let me put it this way. If I could, I think I'd have a little bit more money than I have right now.
But I'm also pretty active locally, moderately active locally anyway, with the Ingress game around here. So.
All right, and I'm a game designer. That's my day job, and I love geocaching. I've found about a little over 1,300 caches so far. I've cached in, I just completed a milestone where I found a cache in all 48 of the contiguous states, so I have two more to go. That's going to be some frequent flyer miles going out there. I also am very interested in this new genre of location-based games. Geocaching is just one example of it. There's older examples such as letterboxing, orienteering, and then there's a lot of smartphone apps that are coming up. The Ingress, I'm a big player of Ingress, and in researching for this talk, I found out about some other games that I definitely am going to want to be playing. So I also want to find out a little bit about the audience here. So how many of you have gone geocaching? Okay. Of those geocachers, how many have found more than 10 geocaches? How many have found more than 100 geocaches? How many have found more than 1,000 geocaches? Okay, the two of you, how many caches and what's your cacher name? Wow. Okay, welcome, and feel free to participate in this, you know, because you found more caches than I have. Have you been to any mega events? What's the last mega event you went to? You were in Seattle. I was in Seattle, too. Okay, well, okay. Okay, great. And in the back? Oh, wait, do we have a microphone that we can write out to these guys? Mm-hmm.
We used to do with Boy Scouts all the time, too.
So you found over 1,000 geocaches, but you have not logged them online?
No, I have not.
Interesting.
I have a friend that does it online. I just do it for fun.
Okay, great. Right. Okay. And what's your friend's geocacher name? Do you know?
I'm not exactly sure
okay.
what her name
all
is.
Right. Okay. All right, so now geocaching aside, has anyone here ever found a letterbox? Any letterbox? Okay, so the three of you, also geocachers, so you found hybrid letterboxes, I assume. Have you made your own rubber stamp for the letterboxes? Or okay, and how many, okay, now we're going to another kind of game. How about Ingress? Anybody here an Ingress player? Okay, awesome. So I want to ask which faction you're on, but I don't want to start a fight, like, right now. But all the Ingress players, you know there's a cross-faction meetup that's going to be happening tomorrow night, 10 o'clock, here in the Hilton on the third floor at the swimming pool. Also, if anybody is interested in playing Ingress after this talk, or if you're Ingress players and you need more invites, Niantic was kind enough to send me some extra invite codes, so feel free to come up and grab those. Any other location-based games that I didn't mention that someone is really hoping I talk about in this? Yeah. Munzees. Okay, I'll definitely be talking about Munzees. Anything else? Okay. All right. Okay. So, Munzee isn't on this list, but I was going to mention it at some point. Also with geocaching, geocaches can be on a website, geocaching.com. Geocache is kind of the biggest of them. However, there are other sites. There's open caching, and there's two different kinds of open caching. Garmin, who makes GPSs, has their own opencaching.com site. And there's also this open caching network where the suffix will be dependent on the country, opencaching.germany.de, there's a Sweden, so it kind of different sites everywhere. But I'll be mostly talking about the major site, which is Groundspeak geocaching site. Anyone interested in GPS games, also there's a site called gpsgames.org. Foursquare, anybody here participate in Foursquare? Okay. Which is a location-based game. You have to be somewhere and then check in, and then whoever has the most check-ins at a particular location can become mayor of a location, and so there are game-like elements there. Munzee, I'll be going into Ingress in much more detail. Munzee is something where there will be a QR code that'll be in different locations, and you have to have a smartphone, and you have to go and you have to scan that QR code to get credit for it, and you also get credit for placing these QR codes. Question? Okay, so backing up for geocaching is a high-tech scavenger hunt. People will go and hide things, which are usually a box, Tupperware box, with a logbook inside of it, and they'll record the latitude and longitude coordinates, and then they'll post these coordinates online at a site called geocaching.com or one of these other sites that I'm mentioning. And then other people will take their GPSs or their smartphones and will go and try and find that box. They find the box, then usually they'll open it, they'll sign the logbook inside saying they found it, and then they'll put the logbook back in and put the box where it was and conceal it as well or better than it was when they found it. The containers are not always this size. They can be much smaller, much larger. This is a typical size container. This is a bison tube container, so people will unscrew it and there will be a logbook. And you can get itty-bitty little thimble-sized containers with a magnet, which will often be used for what's called urban hides. You won't have, in a city, you can't really place this somewhere. You can't place it somewhere where it's going to stick around for very long. So people will take these, and it's almost very James Bond. They'll hide this, like, under a fence somewhere or under a parking meter.
Or on a guardrail.
Or guardrail, yeah. Guardrail caches are very common. And then when you
I didn't
there,
say you should do
you
it.
Unscrew it, and then there'll be a little strip of paper in there, and then you put your initials on the piece of paper, and then you go from there. These are called what's called nano caches, and then these are micro caches, and then this is more a regular size cache. Often you'll find toys in them as well because families will go geocaching, and it's fun for kids because the rule is if they find a cache with toys in it, they can take a toy as long as they put back a toy, something of equal or greater value. That's the rule in geocaching. You want to trade equal or trade up. And so it's kind of interesting, the kind of swag that you'll see show up in geocaching. Also, we have these things called trackables, which are little toy things that you might find in a geocache. And these actually have numbers on them. These little tags there have numbers. And so when you find a trackable, you can take it, and then you go online and you enter the number to say, aha, I found this trackable. It is with me now. And then the next cache you get to, if you want, you drop off the trackable. And so someone can see which track their trackable, where is it gone, which cache is it in, who is it with. At the beginning, about 15 minutes before the talk, I said, I've got trackables. And so anyone here who's into trackables is probably going to come up and they're going to record the numbers or take pictures of them so that they can then go home and then log the trackable numbers later. And we might also have a flurry of trading going on at the end of this talk. So that answer.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. Yeah, and this is as good a time as any to do this. I'll show you a typical cache listing. So this is the area around Atlanta. So this is, I'm actually live on geocaching.com right now on Wi-Fi. And we are, I think, We're in this hotel, right?
Nope.
Okay. So the nearest cache here, and this one has a smiley on it because I'm logged on my account, means I found it. So sometimes you'll hear people say, I have a smiley because I found that cache, and then I logged it online. Not everyone logs their caches online. But this particular cache, actually, this one, Arms Wide Open, I think is more interesting. There's a little pocket park here, a little. So those of you who are familiar with the area probably know roughly where this park is. And right near the Western, and near the Atlanta Police Department. So this is a quick ref for it, and each cache has a name. This one is called Arms Wide Open. It was placed by someone, their geocaching name is Sean J. Allen. They gave it a difficulty of 3.5 and a terrain of 1. Each cache can have a difficulty of 1 to 5 and a terrain of 1 to 5. Terrain will give you a sense of how much physical effort is going to be required to get to the cache. So a terrain 1 means wheelchair accessible. Terrain 2, there's some debate, but basically a stroller mom could get to, a really determined stroller mom, you know, was pushing a stroller, got some kids, you know, small children, she could get to it. Terrain 3, you're probably going to be climbing or kind of going through terrain where you have, kind of have to push trees aside. Terrain 4, you really don't want to take small kids on a terrain 4, unless they're really experienced outdoors kids, because there might be poison ivy, there's going to be some climbing involved, there might be places like a sheer drop-off down to a river. And then terrain 5 is something where you probably need special equipment to get to it, so rappelling gear, or a kayak, or you really need to be prepared.
Or scuba equipment.
Scuba equipment. There's a cache actually on the International Space Station, which was placed by Lord British, Richard Gary, who went up there. And so that's a terrain 5. You need a rocket in order to get to that one.
The Mars probe took one to Mars.
Oh, it did? Okay.
And I have a feeling it's probably also a difficulty 5 because, well, yeah.
Yeah. So, difficulty 1 means it's out there in plain sight. So, like, if you go down the path, you see, like, boom, there's an ammo can under a tree. Ammo cans are great because they're waterproof, they're secure from the elements, though. Hiding an ammo can in an urban environment, probably not a really good idea. There's been many, many, many calls to bomb squads.
Make that a bad idea.
Really
I've
bad
actually
idea.
Got a story on that if you'd like later.
Okay, sure. So a difficulty 2 would be something that an experienced cacher can probably find, you know, within a half hour, kind of looking around and searching. Difficulty 3, even an experienced cacher might have to do multiple trips. Sometimes you look for the cache, you don't find it, you post what's called a DNF, did not find, and then you go back the next day and you keep looking and looking and looking. Some people will return to a site several times to find it. Some people, if they can't find it, will look to see who else has found it and get on the phone and say, hey, where is it? It's called a PAF, a PAF, phone a friend. Difficulty 4, and then you start getting into mental and physical challenges. Some I'll go into or later, there's puzzle caches where you have to solve. It might be a mathematical problem. It might be a code that you need to crack in order to find a cache. Not everyone has to find all caches. So you look at the difficulty and terrain and kind of find something that meets your own skill level, your own limits. I wouldn't go after a terrain 4 or a terrain 4.5 unless I had someone with me. So other people, no problem. They're just going to go for it. Now the size, you're asking, here again in the quick ref, the farther to the right it is, the larger the cache is, with one exception. So this little dot here means it's a micro cache. And in this particular case, and as a spoiler, I'm going to just tell you guys, there's a statue in that park with a man with his arms wide open. And under one of his shoes is a tiny little camo tape bag with a logbook inside of it. And that's the cache. It's been there since 2009. So if you go find it, you can read the logbook and read all the signatures of all the people that have found that particular cache. One of them will be mine, and the other one will be Lois. Yeah. What would happen if you located and just took it home? It happens all the time. We refer to it, other cachers won't know if it got taken away or an animal dragged it off or what. We'll just know we look for the cache and it's gone. And this is part of geocaching culture. Geocaching started becoming popular right around the time that Harry Potter started becoming popular. So if a geocacher is looking for something, you want to be careful that other people aren't seeing you while you're looking. And the saying is, don't let the muggles see you.
So, and a cache that disappears because we think somebody picked it up and wandered off with it is said to have been muggled.
And what'll happen is, in this case, Sean Allen. Okay, I'm going to go to the wider, the full page for it, which isn't displaying quite the way I want. Okay. So the actual coordinates are here in both regular latitude and longitude, also in a UTM format. I know it's in Georgia. In my case, it says this cache is 486 miles southeast of my home location, which is in St. Louis, Missouri. And then each time someone finds it, with the most recent on the top, they will put, that they found it and what it was like. It was a pretty day. In this case, DragonCon finds. So this is somebody posted today that they found this cache. VPL13, are you here in this room? Checking? Okay. Because they didn't know there was a geocaching talk. And they found a total of 85 caches. So either that was 85th or somewhere around 85th. And so the total, that cache has been found 566 times since it was placed. 54 people couldn't find it. That's what this little blue thing is. It's a DNF. Either because I hate caches like this. In an area where the signal bounces like crazy, two-word cryptic clues are worthless. Okay, well, people are generally not happy when they can't find them. So there's a hint. And the hint is encrypted with ROT 13. It's a Caesar cipher, 13. And the hint is roof tight for this one, which is a really cryptic clue because even after you decrypt it, you have to decrypt it again. It's an anagram. And the anagram decrypts to right foot. So a cache owner, if someone just took it, what you'd start seeing here is you'd start seeing DNF, DNF, DNF. Couldn't find it, couldn't find it, couldn't find it. Too hard for me. My GPS wasn't working. Either I was unlucky or maybe it's been muggled, maybe it's been muggled. And after a few DNFs, it would be up to the cache owner to go and check and see, is it still there? It's very rare that a cache will go unattended for a long period of time. There are definite instances of caches which have been placed that aren't found for like 5 years. But in general, especially in an urban setting, they need replacement periodically. The log gets full. There's a hurricane comes through and the log gets wet. Or sometimes it just gets wet because cache logs get wet all the time. So any cache owner has a certain responsibility to go and check on it and replace it if it gets muddled. Yes?
And I move across the country. Mm-hmm. What happens then? Do I transfer ownership to someone else, or does it die?
Either way, some cache owners who move will have the caches adopted out to someone else, and so you'll see on a cache listing, and in this case it says a cache by Sean Allen, but it wouldn't be uncommon to see a cache by Sean Allen adopted by Mikhail Loki, and then it would be Loki would own the page, he could edit the page, or Sean Allen could continue to own it, but would just have an arrangement with Loki, like, hey, DNFs, you live near there, can you go check and see if it's okay? Or Sean Allen could say, 2009, it's been a great run, I'm removing the cache, and they would just archive the list, and it would no longer show up on the searches, which would then allow someone else to place a cache in that area. Caches cannot be too close together. There must be at least a tenth of a mile between caches. So the fact that there's a cache in that particular location means that no one else is allowed to place a cache anywhere within a tenth of a mile. So these are probably about a tenth of a mile apart. I can tell just by looking at them. So, that's a question. Okay.
Why is it a tenth of a mile in particular? Is that to do with the GPS limitations, or is it just a convention?
My understanding as to the reasoning behind tenth of a mile, it's a pretty arbitrary number. The idea was that geocaches, well, first off, why would you want to put them that close together? But there's the other side of it that is, if I set down a cache, what we don't want to have happening is people going down the street and tossing a container out the window of the car. But there's also the detail that, well, once you get down below a tenth of a mile, we're talking about a GPS receiver that has an effective,
radius, I guess you could say, of about 9 meters. Well, 9 meters, okay, that's not a small area. And when you consider that my GPS says that I'm within about 9 feet. When I'm within 9 feet of the cache, my GPS says I'm within 9 feet of this location. Your GPS says that you're within 9 feet, but you're actually 18 feet over that way.
And you might be in an urban setting where the signals are bouncing off of buildings.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So it's entirely possible that if in an area like this, there's lots of big buildings. Well, radio signals like to bounce off of big buildings. So just because my GPS may say that I'm within 9 feet of these coordinates, but I'm standing in amongst a bunch of big buildings, and it's entirely possible that the actual coordinates are somewhere half a block that way.
Yes.
Because I'm getting signal bounce. So, yeah.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Hence the tenth of a mile restriction.
Okay. So, moving on to another type. There are different types of geocaches, and sometimes they mix with what's called letterboxing, which actually predates geocaching by quite a bit. Origins go back into the 1850s in England. And there would be a box, usually on someone's estate, and then people would hike to it and would drop off a postcard or a letter. And then someone else coming along would periodically pick up all the postcards and ship them out. That's kind of how it started. And then it kind of evolved into where you would go to the letterbox and there would be a rubber stamp in the letterbox, which you would use to stamp your own logbook to prove that you had been there. And then letterboxers would have their own personalized hand-carved rubber stamp, which they would then use to stamp a logbook in that letterbox to show that they had been there. So if you go to a letterbox and you go through its book, you'll find many very elaborate rubber stamps, page after page after page. Another difference with letterboxes is it's not with latitude and longitude. Obviously, they didn't have GPSs in the 1800s. So what they would do is they would give clues, and they would say, starting at the road, follow the path until you find the Three Sister Tree, which might mean, follow the path until you find a tree with three trunks that are all woven together. And so it would be more of a treasure hunt. The way to find out if there was a letterbox in your area, sometimes they would publish them in a kind of newsletter, but often it was just word of mouth. So it was difficult to find out if there was a letterbox. And if you didn't know the area, it would also be difficult to figure out where to start. If someone said the Tree of Three Sisters and you've never been in that area of England, you really kind of need a local person to help you out. Here in the United States, we have this website, letterboxing.org, now, where often letterboxes will be listed, but again, if you don't, it'll say start at the middle doorway, which could mean start at the Gateway Convention Center. But if you don't know that the area has a Gateway Convention Center, it makes it tricky to know where to start. Letterboxes also tend not to be maintained. So if someone places a letterbox, they walk away from it. And if it disappears, they just never know because it's not easy to log them online. So it's a variant of a location-based game. So now getting into some of the smartphone games, there's several, and I will not be doing a comprehensive list. This was Zombies Run. It was a Kickstarter-funded project in 2011, and it's a fitness game. So you have on your smartphone, and zombies are chasing you. And so it'll tell you that you have to run to a certain location. You're runner five. And so there's an elaborate kind of backstory to it. Evidently, you can play it if you're out running in the wild. You can also play it on a treadmill. I haven't played it personally, but it sounds like a game that I want to check out. I love their tagline, get fit, escape zombies, become a hero. Has anyone here played this game? Yeah. Anything you'd like to say about it? Or microphone?
The main thing's the storyline. It's a really good storyline,
mm-hmm.
and you're more or less listening to the story as you run.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if anyone who's getting to play it, if you don't run fast enough, the zombies don't chase you. I'm slow.
Okay.
It took a while for me to figure out I had to run faster.
Okay. But can you do it while walking?
Yes, you can. It's all relative. Uh-huh. But if you walk, the zombies don't. You can still play the game, you still get to pick up items, you still get to collect things, it's still a game. But until you get to a certain speed, zombies.
And how often do you play the game?
I haven't played it a lot lately, but I always play it 2 or 3 times a week.
Okay, alright. And I think the gentleman in front of you is also playing.
Oh, I don't have much to add to that. It's it is a great game. I mean, the zombies do chase you, and they come on you fairly quickly, so it's like a beeping, like beep, beep, beep.
That'll get me, beep, get the adrenaline
beep,
going, yeah.
Beep, beep. And, you know, and then you, once you get out of the zone, they, you know, they slow down, and you've successfully gotten away.
If they don't chase you, think they think you're one of them. It's like, this one's moving too slowly, it's one of us.
Okay. Foursquare, I talked about this a bit already, so let's skip that. Ingress. So this one's Google is funding this, and they've had about 1 million downloads of the app. To describe Ingress very briefly, and I know there's several Ingress players here in the room. Imagine that all around us there are specks of energy that are floating in the air. But you can only see them if you have an Android phone or an Android tablet. And then once you see them, you can walk towards them to collect them. Once you collect enough, your health bar, your energy bar goes up, and you'll find these areas where it's called the exotic matter, the XM, is emerging, these kind of fountains, portals. And a portal will be white if it's unclaimed, or you can attack it and claim it for your team. Blue versus green. Blue is resistance, enlightened. Green is enlightened. And it's basically a big game of capture the flag. These portals are generally going to be at interesting locations. They'll be at sculptures. They will be at interesting buildings. And so, similar to geocaching, you'll need to go to a specific location in order to find the portal there. Though there's a little more freedom on where portals can be placed, because you don't have to get permission, which is something that these guys are going to do. And I've got a slide coming up where we'll talk about the permissions involved in placing a geocache. So this is also a screenshot of someone on green team who had just made level 8. At the top left of this, you will see that 8. And that's the maximum number of levels you can have is 8, and they needed 1.2 million AP of action points to get there. Though the game is still in closed beta, you need an invitation in order to get into it. If anybody's interested in playing, I do have extra invite codes here, which Niantic sent to me. Once you find a portal, and each one of these kind of fountain locations is a portal, you can hack it and get stuff from it, which might be defensive items to use, offensive items to use, keys, and other types of mods that you can get. Or if the portal is of the opposing color, say you're green and you approach a blue portal, or you're blue and you approach a green portal, you can fire bursters to try and knock down its defenses in order to capture it for your team. There's a pretty elaborate community involved with it. The app's had about 1 million downloads. I think active players, judging by who's looking at the YouTube videos that come out each week, I'm guessing in the neighborhood of 30,000 active players around the world right now. And it's an active development. So each week, they're changing it. They're changing the rules a little bit, modifying things, making certain things easier, other things harder. And it was on XKCD a while ago. I'll read this for those of you who say, hey, party tonight? We'd all love to see you. Come and see your new place. Wait, what? We want to hang out. We're not, like, good friends. I know, but we were thinking about it, and we really like you. You should have us over tonight for, like, an hour. It'll be fun. Sure. And the reason is, the guy, I still don't get why you're suddenly so excited to hang out, is because his house is right next to a bunch of portals. And so people want to go there. And a player will often go to a portal, and they'll hack it, and then if you wait a few minutes, you can hack it again, and you can hack it, like, 4 times in a certain 4-hour period.
It depends on the mods that it has. It depends on a number of factors that are kind of going on with that portal. As an average, I want to say you can hack it once every, is it 5 minutes? Yeah, once every 5 minutes and a total and maximum of 4 times within 4 hours. Unless, of course, it's got mods.
Yeah. And Another difference between geocaching and Ingress is once you find a geocache, you found it. You don't want necessarily to go back to that geocache again. Ingress, once you found a portal, you tend to be revisiting that same portal over and over and over again. It doesn't have that same sense of, oh, I want to find a portal in another state, or I want to find a portal in another country. If you have high-powered portals near you, you can basically get everything that you need. Also, the blue versus green. I was having dinner with the Niantic folks, and we were talking about online communities and different games. And there's, in my opinion, this blue versus green can tend to be a little psychologically exhausting after a while, because you'll meet people in the game, and instantly they're either your friend or your enemy. And there's very little to do to kind of build up relationships with people that are on the opposing team.
I'd actually have to disagree with that. Okay. It just so happens that there's a couple locally where she was green. Well, she is green, and he was blue.
Okay, all right.
Another kind of yellow?
Ah, yes.
Okay. I didn't know if anyone else had an opinion on that, or do you find, you're blue, or, oh, you're green, and kind of antagonism starts up, or is it we're all playing the same game? Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the game, but how do you know what team you're going to be on, or how does that work?
You pick it.
Yeah, at the very beginning, it will, by default, you're blue, and there's things that will show up. You'll be able to see what's on the blue comm channel, and it'll give you some backstory of the game. And then partway through in the storyline, it'll say, okay, do you want to stay on blue, or do you want to switch over?
I was going to say that I've experienced the moment when someone asks you what your faction is, and there's this tension in the air right before you answer.
Right, yeah.
Schrodinger's cat of, are you going to be my friend?
Right. Yeah. So we'll see if they start doing more cross-faction things. And I mean, I think I'm a good person, and but when I play intensively. And I'm on green, and so if I'm in a city and there's a lot of blue portals, I'm attacking those blue portals all the time. And I've had some blue players get very angry with me. Oh, you're vandalizing our portals. And no, I'm playing the game.
That's right.
And if I'm attacking...
No, I'm not. I'm taking them back for my side.
Yeah, and it's a good thing, because in order to level up, you need to capture a portal. So if everything is just one color and stays that color, nobody levels up. It's very difficult to get points. Which is another thing that's a little odd about the game, is in some games you capture something and then you want to hold on to it. That's how you proceed in the game. Whereas in Ingress, once you capture something, you kind of want it to be attacked so that your lower level players can then attack something in order to level up. So they're still kind of working out the rules on it, but we'll see what they do with it. Okay. Any other Ingress comments? Okay. Sure.
And it's really unique about Ingress versus some other location-based gaming is the requirement in order to get a portal to the highest level, to level 8, is you have to have 8 level 8 players to each add one of their resonators or one of their pieces of equipment to that portal. So you're kind of forced into the social aspect of it, which again is, I think, the coolest part of the whole game is the community around it.
Yep.
So that requirement, and again, you may have, faction battles whenever one faction knows that, hey, 8 level 8s are getting together to go make level 8 portal or make level 8 farm, and then the other team shows up and you're there for 2 hours until everyone is out of resources and goes home. Or then fakes that they're going home and then comes back 20 minutes later when the other team is running. So, I mean, it can be really cool on both sides of it, and it all depends on what kind of player you are, is, how you treat the other faction. There's a lot of camaraderie,
yeah,
cross-faction often, and then there's a lot of not so friendly. But yeah, the cool part again is just that you're kind of required to play together, either with friends or with the community, so you build kind of a social network.
Absolutely, and I love the game. I play it all the time. It tends to vary somewhat from city to city in places I play. In some cities, it's very dynamic. Like, if I capture a portal, there's probably someone showing up within 10 minutes to flip it back, regardless of whether or not they get experience points for it. Other places, you show up and there'll be 15 portals, all white. None of them, they've all decayed. And I'll just claim them all. And as long as I keep them recharged, I can be like 500 miles away and no one ever attacks those portals. So it's a very quiet area. Some cities, are very cooperative and cross-faction. In one of the Ingress reports, their weekly video newsletter, they talked about it was a Canadian city where they needed to link portals, and they made a design of the Canadian maple leaf out of blue and green links, and like they took it all down, and then they did it, you know, with opposite links. And so the amount of cooperation that took from both sides was amazing. In St. Louis, where I'm from, that would never, ever happen. Ever. I've suggested, like, hey, let's all get together for a cross-faction barbecue, and it's like, I don't want to hang out with them. There's so much mistrust. Also, different play styles. What I call an HAP, a highly active player. If there's an area with highly active players, they're going to control the game. If other people are playing casually, they can, you know, try and capture a portal, but it's going to be gone. I've had people follow me. I was in New York, and I was at a hotel, and I was like, oh, okay, there's a portal near the hotel. I'm going to go capture that portal. So I walked out there, and I captured the portal, and I was placing my resonators, and I saw, oh, it already flipped to the other color. Okay, well, but there was no one standing there. There has to be someone within, what, 80 feet in order to capture a portal. Like, there's empty lots on either side. There's no one near me. So I was saying, okay, did someone hack? Did someone spoof their location? And then I realized that a truck had driven by, and someone was in the truck, and they were hacking. And I'm like, okay, this is a highly defended portal. So I got in my car and I drove away, and that truck followed me. And I knew that whatever I did, they were going to flip it back. And that was their style of playing the game. I call it fireman play, meaning there's people, if they control everything in a city, what else is there to do? Because you control every portal in the city. All you're going to do is wait for a portal to be attacked. And then, you know, firing goes out, they slide down the pole. To defend the portal. That's a style of gameplay, but it can be a little daunting to someone else that happens to be visiting the area.
Police can be involved. Like, yeah, this is Black Van following you down the road. Can someone do something about it, please?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there have been a few incidences of police having to get involved. As a matter of fact, we have a farm that used to be up in Marietta. Yeah, in this case, it was Marietta. Was it 72? 72 portals within a, what is it, 1 square mile? One city block? Okay.
72 portals.
It's the old Confederate cemetery just south of Marietta.
So daylight
on. Well, needless to say, there were some situations that occurred, and a heads up was given to the Marietta police that situations had occurred, and needless to say, the entire farm was removed from the game. So you kind of have to be careful to a certain extent with talking to the authorities, but at the same time, you also have to think about, you know, is it worth going in there when I'm not supposed to be there?
So the situation, I'm trying to understand, there's a cemetery which technically closes at dusk. But because there were so many portals there, Ingress players were sneaking in after sunset to hack the portals to continue playing.
Well, and there was another situation where
and,
there was
but,
a...
But that's what happened?
That's part of it,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
There's more to it than that, but...
Okay.
Okay, I mean, okay. I can... There were also a couple of situations where there was some... And unfortunately, I hate to say this, this is both sides are guilty of this one. There was some not good driving going on, and there were a couple of occasions when people used their cars to block out the other faction, to keep the other faction out while we were flipping the farm. Or and by we, I mean literally either side, you know.
Aggressive play.
Well, then again, that farm was a Smurf farm constantly, and it was not. It was, and it was a it was a level 8 Smurf farm for 3 months. Was it, John? 3 months, John? 3 months long straight blue level 8 blue Smurf farm? Yeah.
Constantly changing, which is great. Gameplay last week is different from this week's, which.
Yeah.
Really helped the monotony of it, but there was a 2-month period where they had changed the codes on shields and basically made everything really hard to take down. And when you have 72 portals in a very close proximity, It was nigh impossible to take down. We would roll in there with 12 people and couldn't take it down.
Let me put it this way. I know I went in there with a crew on at least one occasion. I dropped into the middle of the farm and decided to toss an 8-burster at the time. And I took, I think it was 30,000 XM worth of damage, which, keep in mind, I've got a 10,000 XM bar. That's all. So 30,000 XM within... one drop out.
So to translate that a little bit, you've got your health bar, and normally if you're just attacking one portal, you attack it, and then often it attacks you back, and it knocks you down 5% of your energy, 10% of your energy. But if you're attacking and there's multiple portals, you attack once, and they all attack back at the same time, and it'll knock you down 500% of your energy.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I burned 10, 15, 8 cubes that day.
Okay. Anyway, it's a very compelling game.
it all boils down to respect the places you play.
Exactly.
That's what our entire community learned that day when those portals got removed, is respect the places you are. The community is now pulled together and taking care of that. 2 weeks from now, we're going to another cemetery as a volunteer day. Non-Ingress Ingress players just showing up to help out and volunteer to clean up. We also, that same day, we're doing cross-faction picnic. The community comes together in several different ways outside of that. But the key to it all is just respect the places you play.
And the people, and try to be very aware of the psychological factors in play. There was this experiment way before, decades ago, there was an experiment in California, I forget the name of the experiment, where a professor took a bunch of students and told half of them that they were going to be prisoners and half of them that they were going to be jailers. I don't know if anyone remembers the name of this experiment. Yeah. And what they found is very rapidly people would psychologically start believing those roles. And the professor had to stop the experiment because of just the psychological damage. He was starting to get drawn into it as well. And I see some of those factors in Ingress. The sense of, okay, I'm green, that means blue players are bad, evil. I shouldn't trust them. Whereas I know that, Ingress aside, if I met one of these players here at DragonCon, playing Settlers of Catan, no problem. But, in Ingress, there is this tension, I think, as you were describing, which can happen. It doesn't always happen, but it can happen. So it's just something to be aware of. I found just mentally thinking, I'm green today, but I could be blue tomorrow. If I resign this and then start up a blue account, and I find that's something helpful for mental health. Though I know the green players will go, you switched to blue, you betrayed the team. Anyway, okay.
I had a quick question on
sure.
that. Do you know if Google's working on doing their glasses project with us?
Yes.
Incorporating into that?
Google, this is integrated on Glass.
I don't know what that is.
It's an augmented reality program they've got going. Basically, you're wearing like a pair of glasses or something, and then they'll be doing an overlay. Like, say you've got your tablet and you've got a camera going. Mm-hmm. They'll be doing an overlay over that of a whole bunch of different things that maybe going on around you. It could be used for tourism, like commercially, for stuff like it. Walk this way for this, like a real type of thing. But in this case, you'd be like looking around through these glasses and actually seeing your different points versus doing it on a GPS basis.
There's a popular theory that Ingress is just data mining for Google to do a tourism app for Glass. They tell people, go out, take pictures of interesting things, tell us their story. Well, they're going to have that data if they stop the game tomorrow. They still have the data.
Yeah, that's an interesting rumor that's been going around. And Ingress actually evolved from another app called Field Trip by this company, Niantic, where they were showing a database of interesting places to go in different areas. And the app was there, but then when they added this game layer of it, this Ingress layer of, okay, now there's portals at these different locations, all of a sudden then it became more glorious. People were going to these locations because they wanted to compete. Niantic has been asked if there's data mining going on, and they've denied it. But it does kind of naturally feel like, oh yeah, that they're gathering this data, but
if you aren't paying for it, somebody is.
Okay, geocaching. So we've gone over kind of the structure of a geocaching page. One thing I do when I'm traveling is you can do a search on the geocaches that are in a particular area, and then you can sort them by this blue column, which is favorite points. So geocaching members who log online and have a premium account, which is very cheap, it's like $35 a year, every 10 caches, they can give a cache a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Every 10 caches, you get a point that you can then assign if you want. And you can easily search in an area to see what are the caches that have the most favorite points. And anything over 100 favorite points, you probably want to go take a look at. It's going to be an amazing view. It's going to be an interesting gadget cache. We'll talk about gadget caches in a minute. Or there's going to be something else really interesting about it. Now, types of geocaches. The cache that I talked about here, where you just go and you find the logbook, you sign the logbook, you put it back, it's called a traditional cache. Most caches are traditional caches, but there are other types of caches. Multi-cache is one where you go somewhere and you don't find the logbook, you find a clue, which will take you to the next section. Sometimes you get multiple clues that will take you to the final, and then you sign the log there. That's a multi-cache. Virtual cache, there's no log at all, but there's something you need to do at the location, like if there's a veterans memorial, which isn't always a good place to place a cache because it's a high traffic area. But there might be something like, go to this memorial and there will be a quote on the western wall. Who made that quote? And then if you email that information in, someone will say, okay, you can log this as a find. You can get credit for finding this virtual cache there. They no longer allow virtual caches because there was so much debate about what was a cool enough area to be a virtual cache. I mean, people were like going into the woods and throwing a tennis shoe and saying, okay, go tell me the brand of the tennis shoe, and saying that's a virtual cache. And it was just dumb. And so they stopped them, but there's still many grandfathered virtual caches around, and they're well worth visiting. If you see a virtual cache, it's probably a must visit. Then there's the puzzle or the mystery caches. I'll talk about a little bit more about these in a sec, which involve codes or something you need to solve in order to find the coordinates. An event cache is a meeting, like a mega event, a convention. DragonCon can't be an event cache because there's so much else going on, but if the convention here were just about geocaching, then we would make an event cache. People would come in and we'd have a logbook, they'd sign the logbook, you'd get credit for a cache for having come to the event. Earth caches are similar to virtual caches, but generally involve something to do with geology or you have some sort of measurement you have to do. There's an earth cache nearby at Peachtree Center, where I think you have to look at the rock that's around the metro station there and get some sort of a sense of like how high the tunnel is or how much rock there might be, and then send that in to get credit. Then there's Wergos, which are games. They're simple games, and you can play them on your GPS, you play them on your smartphone, and it's almost like a choose-your-own-adventure kind of thing because the smartphone knows where you are. And I wrote a Wergo in St. Louis called Where My Zombie Go. And you would go to a location, and it would say, okay, you're talking to this doctor, and you click next, and you get the information. The doctor says, you need to help us find patient zero to build the vaccine to stop the zombie plague. And you need to go here for your next clue. And so you get an arrow, and you follow it to your next spot, and then it'll say, a zombie's attacking you, and the phone goes, rrr. And you have to decide, are you going to attack the zombie, or are you going to run away from it? And so you make these simple choices, and then kind of are exploring an area as you're going to these different locations, and eventually find patient zero and build the vaccine, and then it says, oh, and thank you, here's a cache. And they'll give you a location to a cache that you can sign the logbook, and then you have a where to go cache. And then there's letterbox caches, which we already talked about.
Does the where I go now work on the phone?
Yes. In fact, it's working more on the phones than it is on GPSs. Garmin was supporting Wergos with a few of their GPS lines, the Oregon and I think the Montana.
Colorado, was it?
Maybe the Colorado, but with the Montana, they're not supporting Wergo anymore because it just wasn't that popular. But there are Wergo emulators on the iPhone and on the Android. Android is called Where You Go. iPhone, Wergo. There's three builder programs, one by Groundspeak called Wergo Builder, and two builder programs that are coming out of Europe, one called Earwego, like ear. E-A-R, and one called Erwigo, U-R. And I hosted some events where we just get a bunch of people together in one weekend and just make a Wergo game, a cartridge, cache, whatever you want to call it. Challenge caches. These are puzzle caches, and the puzzle is you need to achieve some other goal before you're allowed to log the cache. So, for example, this is a Delorme map. for Georgia. And so there might be a challenge that you have to find a cache on each page of this map. It's called the Delorme Challenge, so I don't know if you guys can see it, but all the little grid here. And then once you found a cache on every page, then you're allowed to sign the challenge cache. Or there might be a challenge, find a cache in every county in Georgia. Or find a cache in every state of the United States. Or find a cache every day. It doesn't have to be in a location. It might be find a cache every day for a week before you can log this challenge. And there's hundreds of different challenges around. Like, find a cache that starts with the letter, you know, all the letters of the alphabet. So
alphabet.
Yeah. Or find a cache where the last letter in the cache name starts with every letter of the alphabet. And so people can just make up kind of any challenge that they want. The Jasmer, the two best known challenges are the Jasmer challenge and the Fizzy challenge. The Jasmer challenge means to find, you can see the date that a cache was placed, and you want to find a cache that was placed in every month since geocaching began. Geocaching began in May 2000, which is when President Clinton signed the order ending selective availability, meaning that all these military GPS satellites could now be accurate signals to civilian GPS receivers. So the first caches were placed in May 2000. So to complete the Jasmer challenge, you need to find a cache placed in May 2000, in June 2000, in July 2000, every single month. And it's pretty easy to find caches that have been placed every month in the last 6 or 7 years. Finding caches that were placed in 2000, they get muggled, they go away, and there's only like 5 caches left that were placed in like August 2000. Not exactly 5, but very, very few. So when I was here at Dragon Con last year, I wanted to go get a cache near Lake Lanier because it's one of the few caches left in the world that was placed in, I think, August 2000. So I took a morning off from Dragon Con to go run out there and get that cache. The Fizzy challenge, remember when I was talking about difficulty and terrain, difficulty 1 through 5, terrain 1 through 5. So you end up, and you can go 1.5, 2, 2.5, 3. So you end up with a grid with 81 different blocks in the grid. And there's a challenge to find a cache in every single one of those 81 blocks. It's called the Fizzy Challenge, sometimes the well-rounded cacher challenge, because a cacher in California named Fizzy Magic, and he chose that name Fizzy Magic because he was a physicist and he was a magician. So his name was Fizzy Magic, and he was the first person to write these database programs that would help you look at, you know, all the different difficulty and terrains that you've done. So someone named a challenge after him. Cache Across America. So Jasmer and Fizzy, those are like the top two. And then other challenges, the Delorme challenges are very popular. County challenges, there's a challenge going on right now called the August 31 Days of Geocaching Challenge, where Groundspeak is encouraging everyone to find a cache every single day in the day of August. Have you been doing every day? Every day, okay. Just a couple more days to go, because maintaining that 31-day streak is tough. You really got to plan things out. And then there's caching. You're at a streak
of 909.
909
Today
days.
Will be
910.
Holy cow.
Oh.
Wow.
Nice.
Pretty dedicated.
That's tough. So, okay, I could talk to you for an hour about how you're managing to maintain a streak.
It's tough, I can say.
Yeah. I mean, just doing a week can be hard, depending on how much time you have available. Then there's Cache Across America, which is you want to find a cache in every state, but not just any cache in every state. Specific cache in every state. So the Georgia cache is in one of the parks southeast of Atlanta. The Wyoming cache is near Yellowstone Park. The Montana cache is along the banks of the Missouri River. And people who are working on this challenge are trying to find each one of those specific 50 caches. Only 12 people have done it so far. I'm working on it. I found 43 of the working, but Hawaii and Alaska are going to be tough. That's going to be some frequent flyer miles. Terrain difficulty, I already kind of went over this, the 1 through 5 on each side. So looking for a cache, we already kind of talked about that, using GPS, smartphones, Google Earth. Now GSAC, I want to go over very briefly, is Geocaching Swiss Army Knife, which is a maintained by a guy in Australia, and it's a great way to figure out, just you load caches into it and then you can sort them by type, you can sort them by how far away they are, when they were placed, who placed them. So if you're working on one of these alphabetic challenges or you're looking, say you only want to see caches that are difficulty or terrain less than 2 and start with the letter T that are within 75 miles of your house, GSAC will do it. But it's got so many options that like you almost like need a class to figure out how to use GSAC. But if you're serious...
Fizzy started writing?
No, Fizzy was writing a different program that would look at what you found and giving data. This is more of a cache. This is more of something to track caches you haven't found. So you can also use it to track caches that you have. Of the how many people here use GSAC of the geocaches? So yeah, anyone who's like really hardcore, you're probably going to be able to go into GSAC.
Dan run a geocacher?
Dan. Was Dan Brown a geocacher? No, but when he was a kid, his parents would send him on quests that were geocaching-like. For example, when he was going to get Christmas presents, his parents wouldn't just give him a present. They'd give him a clue. And then he'd have to use the clue to go to another clue until he eventually found the presents, he and his siblings. And his books are very much like that. Da Vinci Code, Lost Symbol, you go somewhere and you get a clue, and you go gets you somewhere and you go there to get a clue. So I would blame his father.
I just mentioned that because she's worked on a number of books for Brown, analyzing his work in cryptography and whatnot. She's actually got a character named after her in one of the books, The Lost Symbols.
And I'll be speaking about cryptography later on in DragonCon. I'll be giving a talk on cryptography, a talk on Wikipedia, a talk on how to make games in 48 hours, and how to get into the game industry. So, but yeah. okay, let's see. I'm just trying to think. I'm skipping some of these. Acronyms and abbreviations. If you're looking at a log, sometimes you'll see these. TFTC means thanks for the cache. TNLN, took nothing, left nothing. SL, signed log, DNF, did not find. LPCs, very controversial in the community. They're a very easy cache to make. You go to Walmart, there's a lamppost. At the bottom of the lamppost is a skirt. They're never screwed down. So you can lift that skirt and put a cache under the skirt. They're also called skirt lifters. But some people like them because they're very simple. You drive up, you see a lamppost, you know where the cache is going to be. Other people hate them because they have no creativity. And there's an awful little screeching sound, and sometimes there's wasps under there. And phone a friend.
I think I've actually run into a black widow under one of those, too.
Yeah. First to find, I need to mention, there's an element of geocaching where people will compete to be the first person to find a brand new cache. They'll have their phone set up, so if a new cache is published, bing, their phone buzzes, and they're out the door. If they were in here and they were first to find pounds and there was a cache that showed up within 0.2 miles, they'd get up, they'd leave the session, they'd go and race for it. So they're called first to find hounds, and people will compete for how many first to finds they have. I have a few first to finds, but it was just because I happened to be near to the cache, or someone else couldn't find it, and I found it. Just curious, you guys, you have first to finds? Yeah. Have you like found yourself like racing down the highway hoping to be the first person to find the cache? A couple times.
Okay. We were hiding 31 caches, one every day. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh wow.
In our local area in Peachtree City.
Okay.
And so what happened is it became a FDF party because you'd have all these people there, you know, all the geocachers there, basically looking for the cache to be the FDF.
Because they knew it was going to show up there somewhere.
Well, they had their phone set up, it binged, everybody was out the door, and that was the party. It didn't matter if it was, 10:30 at night or,
We also have another cacher who's put out 31 additionally in our area, and he has a $50 iTunes card at the end of the game for the most FPS.
Oh, okay.
So it turned into bit of a money thing there.
Yeah, sometimes the swag where if you take something, leave something, sometimes people will take something and they'll put in a gift card. A $5 gift card, $10 gift card. Puzzle caches, I know we're getting low on time, so I'm just going to cover these very briefly. You'll see ciphers in there, image manipulation. This particular cache, this was the hint, And if you look very carefully down here, you can see where it says B equals 8. Wait, where's the... B equals 8, right there at the base. And then up there, it's got like A equals something. I can't quite see it from there. But you need to get those two clues to pump into a formula in order to find the final. And sometimes you just get these elaborate mathematical formulas, or sometimes it's what someone knows. So if someone knows database program, they might put a clue on the cache page, or you need to do a SQL query of some sort. This one, someone wrote for me. I didn't want it, but he wrote it anyway. These are all square waves, and anyone who knows digital electronics will probably recognize this very quickly as being an indication of ones and zeros. And if you translate the square waves into ones and zeros, and then you get into ASCII, and then there's a story, and then the coordinates were embedded in the story. This is a cache that was in Indianapolis, where that image was the clue, and then you needed to do image manipulation. So here's the image, and then you eyedropper one of the colors, and then you erase. I don't know if you can see it, but there's coordinates that are now showing up in there. No, you can't see it at all, I'm sorry, but I'm happy to show it to anyone. The coordinates are in the crystal ball, but you needed to change the hues and do the color manipulation in order to get the coordinates in there. And it's all kinds of puzzles. It's really, there's no limit to what someone can do. The gadget caches, there's caches where it'll say, you cannot solve this cache if you walk up to it. You cannot solve this cache with a bicycle. You cannot solve this cache with a motorcycle. You can only solve this cache if you have a car, and something that most people have in cars. And what it is you have to drive up to the cache, and you need to get jumper cables, and you connect them to the cache from your battery, and it triggers a mechanism which opens the cache, and then you can get the logbook out of it from there. there's another cache where you're at a coastline and there's a rubber hose sticking out of the water. And you need to get an air pump, which you connect to that rubber hose, and you pump it and it inflates a balloon, which brings a submarine up to the top, and then the log is inside the submarine.
There's actually a variant on that came out of the maker community that's a reverse geocache. It's a box that you build, and it will only open when the GPS inside is at a particular coordinate.
Ooh, okay. I'd like to see that one. NFC, near field communications. People are starting to play with those where they'll make an NFC tag and they'll attach it to a sign. And then you have to have an NFC device of some sort that you hold up to that tag, and then it'll beam signals to your device to get the coordinates to go on from there. There's musical puzzles. You play music by stepping on different things. It just goes on and on and on. It's fantastic. I talked about trackables. So anyone that wants to get involved, go to geocaching.com. You don't have to pay for an account, but I recommend it. There's Facebook groups. There's podcasts, podcaster.com, wonderful resource done by a husband and wife team out of San Diego, Sunny and Sandy. They've been doing this every week for years. They're over 400 shows at this point. And they talk about stories from around the world. They talk about bomb scares. They talk about someone found this cache that hadn't been found in 5 years. Wonderful podcast. GeoGearheads is another fun one. They talk about the techie and this new GPS is out and we like this technology. And then events. You'll find about mega events where hundreds or sometimes thousands of people will go. Like in Seattle, the big block party. I think I'm out of time. I was going to go over some of the controversial parts of geocaching. Blake, did you have anything else that you wanted to talk about real quick?
Real quick, mostly when it comes down to when you're looking for and placing geocaches, the importance of keeping it secret cannot be overstated, because there was a report out of Oregon about a month after the Boston Marathon bombing that someone was seen putting a black pipe wrapped in duct tape under a mailbox. Someone had a really bad day.
Yeah. Is it a bomb or is it a geocache?
It was a geocache, but they were arrested because it was treated as a terrorist incident. The geocaches had been detonated by bomb squads. Headlines we do not like to see. Disneyland shut down for 7 hours because suspicious object found in park.
And, it was a Heidi key. But they didn't know what it was, and they evacuated the park.
Guardrails, we mentioned earlier, a very, very bad place to put them. It's extremely dangerous, and it's illegal. State highway right-of-ways, any railroad right-of-ways, illegal. Designated wilderness areas for the federal park system, you may not put any man-made objects in there. And that's actually one of the big reasons that the virtual caches had to be stripped out of the program, because people were basically, the Park Service was treating it like you are littering in a wilderness area, a designated wilderness area. So you have to be aware of all these things.
I have it about micro caches and I suppose the nano cache while in stores like Walmart could be under a particular shelf somewhere. Is that legal?
It is if you have written permission from the property owner.
And that's key. Any cache, you need permission before placing it. It doesn't matter if it's in a park or in a store or in someone's front yard. You have to have permission.
On that note, be careful that you not only get permission from the property owner, but especially if it's going to be in a dangerous or possibly, should it really be there, make sure that the police know about it. I personally was involved in a cache that happens to be, or at least was at the time, on the south end of the bridge from the lower peninsula of Michigan to the upper peninsula of Michigan. There was a cache there hidden behind the sign at the other end, on the other side of the little parking lot from the south end of that bridge, and it came that close to being detonated due to my having found it. Because it just so happens that what I didn't realize is that the car that was sitting over there in that part of the parking lot happened to be one of the police officers in the local area, and I walked back the cache, which incidentally was an ammo can, back to its hiding spot, and he saw it, and he didn't know what I was doing. I got a phone call about 2 hours later via the person I was staying with. Family going, can you come back to the bridge?
A lot of state and local police departments actually have profile pages on geocaching. They have a designated contact person so that you can confirm that a place is legal to place one and to inform them that it's there in case a question arises.
Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
Nope, you've answered pretty much everything.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we could easily talk for an hour just on the etiquette of placing caches. I think the one thing I would say to someone who's a new cacher is when you find a cache, the best way that you can thank the person who placed the cache is to write a good log. One of the worst things to do is to just write TSTC, thanks for the cache. Sometimes you're just in a hurry and that's all you can do, but you write a nice log. What it was like to find, oh, it was a nice day, I enjoyed finding this cute container, or just, I'm on my way from Atlanta to Nashville, and I stopped by, and I decided to go for this cache. These are things that cache owners like to see, because they enjoy reading the logs. So that would be my one piece of advice. Other than that, just have fun, and use geocaching as a way to make new friends. So, thank you for listening.
Thank you.